All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are yet again for another multi-topic kind of episode here. Dom, first and foremost, how are you feeling now that we are back to wrap up the month of May?
May, I could take a leave. Very excited for the month of June. We have had amazing weather here in Canada over the past week, except today, where I knew my power was going out for at least an hour, and so I was thinking, okay, I'll take a nice walk, I'll just go to the park and relax in the sun for a bit, and instead that turned into a choice between relaxing in the rain or just staying inside in total darkness with my cat, so I naturally chose that instead.
Strong, yeah. A long time ago, in relative terms, at this point, did a podcast about ranking the four seasons from best to worst, and I was a hardcore team spring guy, and this time of year is like exactly what I'm talking about. Unfortunately, here in New England, while it has been amazing for these last couple of weeks, it is already verging on the territory of getting too hot, and we rarely get these days more than the maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks of real peak spring, but I will gladly take it. Although I, like you, Dom, have probably not spent enough time outside while I had the opportunity, and we'll just go on to complain about everything for the rest of the year. But setting that aside, welcome back, everybody. We are here today to talk through primarily some of the most unbreakable records in Survivor history. And I'm sure there will be, first and foremost, plenty that we are forgetting about along the way. So if you think of some that you feel would qualify, certainly feel free to let us know on Twitter. He is at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. We will probably wrap up the month, unless the rest of this takes forever, probably wrap up this month of May with a little more No More Lockies. But first, Dom, pulling a Julie Chen there on you. News has recently broken, by which I mean earlier this morning, that Amazon has officially purchased MGM Studios and their catalog and intellectual property for $8.5 billion, which gives them quite a back catalog to put up on Amazon Prime now. It's something I know they have been working on for a long time, is trying to get enough content to compete in that capacity with your Netflixes and Hulus, etc. But one property, at least potentially, now having changed hands is Survivor itself. Did you see this news, and does it appear that I am reporting this much of it correctly to this point?
Yeah, I saw this news earlier when I loaded up the notes and saw it was right at the top there, and had to take your word that this was actually happening. And I really am not media savvy. You know, I'm no Max Dawson. I don't know the inner workings of the TV and film industry. So when I saw you say Amazon has just bought MGM, I was thinking they bought the casino. Like, what was that? Seems like an awful lot to pay for. But we quickly figured out what was actually going on, and I was not quite sure on what the implication was for Survivor, where, like, obviously, you know, Survivor is associated with CBS, and I think formerly SEG, Survivor Entertainment Group, which was I don't know if that was a subsidiary of something, or I don't know what the terminology is, but this is a common thing, I think, where, like, you hear these this news about one massive company acquiring some other massive company or whatever, and but when you delve into the inner workings of that, what you realize is really all of these massive companies are connected through through some kind of connective tissue, and there's not really too much difference between them.
There's only like 6 companies in the world, really. It's all just a bunch of tax shelters. But yeah, I too am not intimately familiar with how the legalese works and the inside scoop on TV production at this level and which is a subsidiary of whom, etc. But I believe it is the case that, at least based on this one article I read, Survivor would be one of the properties now changing hands. And we've already had Survivor in the form of, I think, only 2 seasons to this point, Heroes versus Villains and Kageyan on Netflix. Plenty more Survivor has been on Hulu, and it seems at least possible, if not now likely, that we could see Survivor hit that triple crown and be as far as I've ever known, only the second show in my experience that has been available on Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime. Incidentally, the other one, which is concurrently available on all three of those platforms, is the History Channel's reality show Alone, which I binged the entirety of sometime during either during quarantine or just before that. Time not really registering as a concrete concept for me anymore over this last year or so. But
is this the equivalent of the Survivor, Big Brother, Amazing Race trifecta?
Yes, this is what I'm getting at. Is I don't think I've ever seen another show do all three, and it would be very impressive just to check each of those boxes, but to do so simultaneously, which I think may at least conceivably be in play just because I know Alone has done it, that would be a very impressive feat as far as I'm concerned, and one of the more impressive things Survivor may have pulled off in recent years. But we will see how all of that plays out. Incidentally, by the way, I believe a new season of Alone starts like in a week, so very excited, or I got fake news from one of my friends, but either way, excited for whenever the next season of Alone is, and I would consider that something worth checking out just for a reality TV fan that I'm guessing most people who are hearing us right now are. But speaking of impressive feats, Dom, let's dive in on today's main topic here, the unbreakable records of Survivor history. And again, already nervous about framing this as like the unbreakable records in multiple different ways, where number one, these are certainly not the only unbreakable records, and I am eager genuinely to hear from people who can flag up some of the ones that we've missed that would fit into this sort of thing. And number two, I feel like the mere fact that we're about to spend however long we are talking about records being unbreakable is essentially a guarantee that one of these, at least, is going to be broken in the future.
Yeah, whoever the holders of these end up being, you know, the Joe's Anglin of the world will be cursing us out for manifesting this into existence. But as far as I'm concerned, the most impressive feats belong to my cat Ravioli, whose toe beans are adorable and perfect and remain unblemished, even after a lot of leaping and scratching, mostly of me and God knows what else. But anyway.
Is he hanging out for the podcast? Is this pertinent to something, or just wanted to give him a shout out?
Sitting right next to me. Yeah,
okay.
And do just want to give him a shout out. I feel like we need to talk about him more often. But in any case, when you look at this list that you've so graciously compiled for this episode, it really does stand out how almost every facet of the game has gone through some kind of fundamental change over the course of 40 seasons, to the extent that basically every one of these awards comes with some kind of necessary context or qualifier where you can't really fairly compare whoever won the award with a bunch of other seasons or a bunch of individual players who maybe would be in contention under kind of scientific conditions where you're keeping everything else equal. And so I don't want us to get bogged down in too much of like, oh, well, we have to disqualify these because of this technicality or whatever. But mostly just to appreciate the achievements for what they are and I guess to assess how likely they are to be replaced by someone else. But even with that in mind, some of that stuff, so for example, the people who have had the most votes cast against them in a single season, almost always that's going to involve having an idol successfully played on you, or I guess unsuccessfully, and racking up the count while remaining in the game that way, or just without even the threat of an idol, or without the idol itself, excuse me, the threat of the idol means maybe you get some split votes put on you when you're not the intended target, or you kind of backdoor into some extra votes that way. And if we had been doing this after, you know, the halfway mark now in the show's run, Heroes versus Villains, at that point, maybe you could say, okay, well, we've had the idol as this recent addition to the show, and so that's something to keep in mind. But we can now focus on those first 11, 12, 13, however you want to count it, seasons where that wasn't really a factor in quite the same way. Now, as we eagerly await season 41, or I guess Survivor South Africa as well, we have had the vast majority of seasons being played with an idol of some form or another. And so that is the lens that we have to view this through now. Is you expect that people are going to get votes kind of by accident through that method, or if they do play an idol, like, it's good for them because they stay in the game. Also good if for some reason they care about that title of who got the most votes in the season. So a lot of that stuff is, you know, that's an example that we can take for granted now, whereas some of these others, it's okay, well, yeah, because this one season had Edge of Extinction, therefore naturally this is going to happen, but how much can you really assume otherwise?
Right, yeah, and a lot of the ones that I have listed as unbreakable are largely because the circumstances have just changed so drastically since the times that these records were being put up that it would take a massive kind of system overhaul for anyone to even be drawing live at breaking these records. And then I also have others that may honestly be more interesting to get into that are, for my money, not quite unbreakable. It's certainly doable, conceivably, to break these records. I just have a personal, at this point, hard time seeing them falling anytime soon. But I'm sure... Yeah.
In some of those cases, that's what makes it even more impressive, is that someone who is not in that category of people who get to play, at least with this question, on easy mode, so to speak, they are nonetheless able to actually overcome that and get that title for themselves.
Yes. So, for instance, one of the ones that I think is kind of interesting from the category of, like, not quite technically unbreakable, people will certainly have this opportunity, I would guess, in the future. It's just so difficult to overcome the benchmark that was put up by Eddie Fox in Karamoan, voting for the wrong person at 9 tribal councils over the course of one season. There will be people who attend 9 or more tribal councils. It's just extremely difficult to get more wrong than that.
Yeah, and this one, people love to chime in saying, oh, well, it's technically not voting incorrectly if it was part of a split and you knew what the plan was, which is definitely true. But the other part of that is sometimes if you're in the minority, you know, what are you going to do? Vote for your friend who you're loyal to and you want to give them your support on their way out, or cast a meaningless vote for someone in the majority who, you know, or you hope at least, is not going to take it too personally because, well, you got to vote for someone. So usually the Eddie's Fox on a given season find themselves in that position where they could easily rack up the score on this count if they wanted to. But I think Eddie does also hold the title for the person who gave themselves enough hope into thinking that something was going to go well for them, and then also just had the rug pulled out from underneath them. Because there were so many times where either Eddie, he thought he was part of this master plan, and then it just fell through, if it ever existed really outside of his imagination in the first place. Or he thought he was dead to rights. He thought he was going home, or one of his buddies was going home. And then, you know, like manna from heaven, someone else was just snatched out of the game instead. So, you know, I don't think he saw the Andrea blindside coming, for example. He was very consciously left out of that. Don't think he saw the Brenda blindside coming, you know, like, maybe often what happens in these situations is someone kind of tips them off, or it's like, well, I can't tell you too much, but if you want to stay in the game, then maybe you should vote for this person. And you kind of do that because you have to, but with no great expectations. But that was the story of Eddie's survival over the season, was, whenever he was in danger, for the most part, something weird would happen that he had no agency in and often no knowledge of whatsoever.
Yes. And I'm totally with you on the idea of someone could quite conceivably rack up a bunch of tallies, I guess, in this department just by being in the know and happening to be on the incorrect, in air quotes, kind of side of a split several times over the course of a season. And that is a different thing to me than what I think the vast majority, if not entirety, of Eddie's voting history was, of just being on the wrong side of it. And you are totally right that there are considerations when you're in the minority pretty much the entire time where it makes sense that you're going to be getting a ton of votes wrong the longer you stick around, especially knowing people aren't going to take that nearly as personally as potentially like turning on it, or having it be seen as turning on like one of your allies or amigos that you for whatever reason know is leaving that night. There are a lot of reasons going into Eddie getting this many votes wrong, but the runaway leader, I believe, in that department. And again, it's totally conceivable that someone could have the opportunity to break that record. I just think it would be very difficult to do. But another one where the opportunity will certainly present itself for this record to be broken, but it's never been touched in the 40 seasons since this first happened, and I can't imagine it ever will be, to such an extent that I am categorizing this as a legitimately unbreakable record. And I am talking about a stat I have brought up many times over the years, but 7 different people receiving votes at the Borneo merge vote as it went 4-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. I think that record has essentially a 0% chance of ever being not even broken, but come close to matched in the modern era of Survivor, where such an overwhelming percentage of the people that are playing are very eager to play a strategic game and are never going to be finding themselves on 7 different people.
What would you say is in like second or third place then? Like what gets the silver medal for not even the most people receiving votes, although maybe that's a good measure, but just the most kind of chaotic outcome when you're looking at the voting chart?
And so this may be a bit unfair, and unfortunately I can't cite any specifics, but Australian Survivor, particularly the early episodes where they have like starting tribes of 12 going to tribal council,
yeah.
And they're all like hyper game bots, or a lot of them are, like trying to have plans and counter plans and alliances and sub alliances all across the island. I feel like we've gotten some like 4-3-3-2-2 votes. I'm not sure exactly how the math works out there, but I feel like there have been some like 4 or 5 way splits in the early days of Australian Survivor.
Yeah, I guess that this also naturally scales with the number of people around at any given time. So yeah, when you have 13 people on a tribe, you know, all voting at once, that's going to lead to some really weird hinky votes sometimes. But if you told me, you know, if someone explained the concept of Survivor to you and asked you, what do you think is going to happen when these two tribes join up at the merge? I don't think this is too unlikely, right? Like, it's one tribe maybe has their game faces on, they figured out the concept of an alliance and that they're holding strong, and then the other tribe is just kind of doing their own thing, and everyone's this one, I'm voting for this person, you're voting for that person, there's no joined up thinking there. That seems like something you're not too surprised would happen, whereas if that happened nowadays it would be completely unthinkable and we'd be coming in here as like a rapid response thinking, what the hell just happened? The timing of it certainly plays into that too. But also, as you get down into fewer and fewer people, that opens up in some ways more space as to what you can do with the numbers that you have. So for example, you know, that's a remove, the 3-2-1 against Courtney, which still to this day is held up as an example of great strategic play. You know, is 3-2-1 inherently more or less chaotic in that sense than the 4-1-1-1-1? I don't know if it is, but in some ways it's a lot more impressive because there is a kind of logic behind it all. And also with the constraints of this is how many people you have, getting to direct everything in all of these different places is more impressive.
The one, and this is not even close to on the same tier for me as 7 different people receiving votes, but as far as people just not being on the right page and having the vote go weirdly, one instance that stands out to me, and I think I had it in my mind that this was on his own elimination, but I'm not entirely sure if that is correct. In Survivor Philippines, there was some point at which Penner just missed the memo on how the rest of the people were voting, and he put his vote on Abby Maria, and then someone left by a vote of like 5-4-1 or something, or maybe it was 4-3-1, and it might have been Penner himself.
It was 5-4-1. That was a Jeff Kent vote.
Oh, okay, which, that's exactly right. That's what it was. Yes.
Yeah, that was so interesting because that was almost a delayed reaction where we get to the merge and no one likes RC, so let's just get her out of here right now. But then after she goes, then everything just kind of breaks wide open, and you kind of saw this in Micronesia too, and we've commented on this trend in the past where you get to the merge, there's one person who a rough consensus forms that we can take them out of the game. So, you know, Cast in Cambodia would be another great example of that. Or, you know, there are lots that you could list. And then you take that piece off the board, and suddenly no one really knows what to do. There's no easy vote anymore. I guess like Wendell as well in Winners of War would qualify there. And so people have to get creative. And sometimes, you know, the game's moving so fast that someone gets left behind. And if you just look at this, if you knew nothing about Philippines, you just looked at the voting chart for the season, seeing that 5-4-1, you would have questions about what was Jonathan doing. But maybe you would conclude, okay, this was a move by him to like misdirect his vote so that this outcome would happen, and he could pretend, you know, he would come back scratching his head all confused and pretend that he didn't know what was going on when actually he was in on it the whole time. Or maybe he was left behind and really had no idea, and he was deliberately left out for some reason or another. So lots of theories you could have, but in some ways those votes are the more intriguing ones, where you look at the chaos of the Borneo merge and you kind of piece together what happened, right? It's, oh, well, Tagi stayed strong, Pagong didn't, and the rest fills itself in. Whereas votes like that, it's much more open-ended as to what the hell was going on.
I honestly can't believe it doesn't happen more often, that one person just thinks the group arrived at a different conclusion than they did, and that ends up being the deciding factor. I feel like the examples are pretty few and far between, and it seems like over the course of however many, 500-600 tribal council over the years, that would have happened at least a few more times. And
this is, yeah. When I have, not that this is a common occurrence by any means, I hasten to add, but like when I daydream or just dream about Survivor, like, oh, what would happen if I was on this season? That in a way is my fear. It's not even that I would be like on the wrong side of a vote, or even that I would get blindsided myself. It's that people would just like forget about me. It's like, oh, it would just take for granted that, you know, when they're listing their 6 votes here and 5 votes over here, they would just pencil me in and then just forget to let me know what was going on, and I would look like an idiot.
So I assume this is a relatively popular Christmas movie in England as well, although that may be totally wrong, but you have some serious Kevin McAllister vibes,
yes.
Both on Survivor and off. But yeah, so another one that I feel like is essentially unbreakable, just because it does not appear to me that they are going to be placing the contestants under conditions this extreme, and at least not anytime soon. Big Tom losing 80-ish, I think it was slightly over 80 pounds in Survivor Africa, I think is a pretty untouchable Survivor record that, again, is worth acknowledging. It's held up this long because there were very few opportunities for anyone to actually overtake that.
Right. You really have to be starting from a high point to be able to lose that much.
Yeah.
Without.
And yeah, I mean, they don't cast Big Tom kind of people anymore, it seems like.
Yeah. And if you were even on that trajectory where maybe you could come close, there's a decent chance you would get Meta back at some point, right? Like that's very much in play. And also it would need to be a season with as brutal conditions as Africa undoubtedly had, and that's one of the frustrating aspects of the kind of back in the day it was so much harder Survivor discourse, where it's not that that's wrong, it certainly was true of some seasons. So, you know, Africa famously incredibly tough, Marquesas, you had the no-nos giving not just the contestants but Jeff and production living hell out there. It's that all of these seasons get lumped together as if, you know, Borneo, where they were being kind of given food, and you see them literally in raincoats across the course of the season, and they go to great lengths to make sure that that season goes off effectively. And if we need to, you know, make sure people are not well fed but at least fed, then we're going to do that. All of those early seasons just get lumped in together as if you can treat them in the same way for the sake of that argument.
Another one that I think is conceivably beatable, and this is an old school record, but it just seems like they're not casting people that would overtake this number, although who knows, maybe we'll see like the return of Joe Del Campo on Second Chance 2, and this will be quickly overturned here. But I would imagine that Rudy playing Survivor All-Stars at age 75 is a record that will never be broken.
I wonder if someone told you Survivor is going to go for 40 seasons. When is the most likely time that someone is going to break that age record? Like, would you think, oh, well, it could happen any time, or would some points in there stand out as more or less likely?
So if you had asked me this back in the year 2000, I would not have had nearly as clear of an answer here. But generally speaking, it feels like, at least in the cases of Survivor and Big Brother, but I think this is a relatively common trend across just kind of reality TV in general, over time, shows just keep casting younger and younger. And so I, knowing what I know now, would say if you told me some unknown reality show from Denmark or whatever, at a certain point in its 20-year run, put on a contestant who was 75 years old, I would, in the dark, guess that that was during a very early season.
So nothing rotten in the state of Denmark, as it turns out.
I don't know what that's a reference to, but I'll...
Well, moving swiftly on. So
what is it, just for the record? So now I'm curious.
It's Hamlet. At least I'm going to Google that quickly to make sure, because if I say that and I get it wrong, then that's just, that's really bad for the brand. But
I'm sure every single listener is out there absolutely floored that I did not pick up on the Hamilton or Hamlet.
It's surely not from Hamilton. I can guarantee you that.
I don't know how how strong of a job I could have done from Hamilton either. I have seen it once at this point, and
you would think there would have been some kind of Hamlet-Hamilton mashup across the years, and if there somehow hasn't been, then me saying that has now birthed that into existence somewhere. So
Hamilton is a copyrighted now concept by Dom and Colin 2021.
Yeah, Amazon, if you're listening, if you want to buy us out as well, then get in touch with our agent. We can work something out. But
okay, well, yeah. Shout out to whoever did pick up on the Hamlet references out there. I'm sure there were people who got it. So congratulations on being drastically better read than me.
I think you're right that, yeah, once you see that trend of every single season, they're casting younger and prettier people, and they're appealing to, I don't even know if it's so much appealing to a younger audience, because when you say that, people assume, they're appealing to Gen Z and, these young whippersnappers who use their TikToks and their YouTubes and so on. But when, as you highlight time and time again, that focus on, families, for example, I don't know if when you have at least two, maybe even three generations, gathering around the television set to watch Survivor as a family on their Wednesday nights, I don't know exactly what they want to see necessarily. Do they want to see just a parade of young, pretty people? Do they want to see these olds, Colin, uglying up their TV screen? Like, what actually are they looking to get out of that?
I think they want the young, pretty people, based on the casual reactions that I have heard, although that is probably heavily skewed towards specifically casual Anna, who is not watching with her whole, with her kids nearby, because she does not have kids. All right, awkward transition here.
Well,
I'm sure she has plenty of very valuable relationships going on in her life, too.
Yeah, like you, of course. That does raise a question, though, of, is the rest of casual Anna's family as casual? Is it like casual, I don't know what her parents' name are. That would be a very weird thing for me to know, but you get where I'm going with this.
So she has a sister who I think dabbled in Survivor by like binging a few seasons and then just kind of gave up, like lost interest or whatever, and moved on to something else. And I don't think ever really went back, but I've certainly threatened her that if she does not start agreeing with me more on these podcasts, that she will be replaced by her sister. So there's at least some sort of casual family going on there.
The big plot twist is if casual Anna had like a hardcore super duper fan sister Diana or whatever, who was writing Survivor fan fiction and going really deep in the weeds on it.
Yeah, that would be good stuff. But regardless, Rudy at 75, I recognize now that I guess on Big Brother, they did put Jerry in on BB10. But first of all, BB10 is kind of an old school season at this point. And second of all, I think they did that like as a deliberate kind of stunt casting, so to speak, for putting in someone who was much older than the rest of the house.
Yeah, so even though as the years go by, life expectancy increases, you would think there would be more eligible golden oldies ready to go. I do think we have moved past the point now where we are likely to ever see someone, I guess, what do you think the cutoff would be? Like, if you had to set the line, are we going to see someone over 70 again, like over 65? Where are we cutting that off?
So I do think, I guess I'm going to begin this by saying, assuming Survivor goes at least another 10 seasons, which is obviously a very bold assumption, but if we are just kind of mapping out a hypothetical next 10 seasons of Survivor, I wouldn't be super shocked if the ages, like the median age, starts coming up a bit after hitting some extremes. I don't have exact numbers in front of me, but I feel like it has been at least slightly rising, although that's probably heavily impacted by Winners at War featuring so many people from so long ago. But as far as the oldest person in the group, if we're going 10 more seasons, I would guess we would get like maybe two or three people in their early 60s. And I'd be pretty surprised to see anyone over 70.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's about right.
Okay. But who knows? Maybe there are plenty more Joes Del Campo out there waiting to get it done at 71 and delight us all over again. But regardless, Dom, I think on the opposite end, though, while I would be shocked, absolutely floored, if we see someone older than Rudy was during All-Stars at age 75, I think I would also, over the course of that hypothetical 10 seasons, be pretty surprised if we went the entire time without setting at least one new record for the youngest Survivor ever.
Yeah, and as you've highlighted, I think they are very keen to eventually be able to say, you weren't even born when Richard Hatch won the first season of Survivor. And at this point, that was like May 2000, right? So that is very much in play. They don't have to break the record in order to do that. And that hypothetical, I guess they're not even a Zoomer anymore. That teen, no, they wouldn't be a teen. They'd be in their 20s. God, they're not too far away from us, even though we're both on the wrong side of that at this point. That person, would they be like in the top five or the top 10 youngest contestants at this point?
I don't believe so. And I remember whenever it was.
Let's assume they were a Survivor baby. You know, people were so excited to see that Borneo finale that they, you know, that they got right down to it. And, you know, 9 months later, the stork delivered unto them a kid who 20 years later would go on to be on Survivor. I don't know where they would fall in that ranking themselves.
I think there have probably been five teenagers or exactly 20-year-olds at this point that they would not be in the among the five youngest contestants ever. But speaking of Survivor babies, Dom, I have absolutely no memory of when this was, other than sometime in the last year or two, we began some random podcast with a side tangent as a player in Major League Baseball was emerging whose dad was like an iconic baseball player when I was growing up. And it was very weird to me to now be seeing Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in Major League Baseball. And I said at the time, and I wish I remembered specifically when it was so I could flag that up for the people, but I think we will someday find the Vlad Guerrero Jr. of Survivor, where whoever it is, their parents played before. And to go back to the concept of Survivor babies, I certainly remember that the person I had at the top of my wish list the first time this came up, and I at this moment have no reason to believe that this wouldn't still be a theoretically good idea. How about the baby we literally saw or heard about be born as Survivor Borneo was filming, and that is Jervis's son, Gunnar Peterson? I think it would be very interesting if they could flash back to clips from season one where Jervis is getting word out on the island that his son has just been born, and he gets to call home and he gets to smoke the cigar and everything. I think CBS would love that, and I would love to see what Gunnar Peterson brings to the table. So I'm reiterating that take one more time, that whether it's Gunnar Peterson or not, I think it would be cool, and we will eventually have some sort of Vlad Guerrero Jr. of Survivor.
Yeah, I would love that too.
Okay, so another couple of records here, Dom, that certainly aren't like theoretically impossible to at least tie, but would be very difficult, I would guess, to overtake would be number one, Denise Stapley in Survivor Philippines going to every single tribal council over the course of the season. It feels to me, although this could be totally wrong, it feels like more often than not these days, there's some sort of pre-merge situation where we're in three different tribes and two of them are going to votes or two tribes are going together or whatever. Weird stuff is going on that I guess doesn't necessarily make it more difficult to pull this off, but with the pre-merge in particular, it feels like not only do you have to lose every challenge, I would still find it pretty difficult to attend literally every single tribal council if you are someone vying for Denise's record here.
What was that tribal council count? How many did she go to?
I want to say 15, but that may be slightly wrong. We had leave without a tribal council. So maybe
hold on, I still have the Philippines wiki page open from fact checking the Pena Hingi vote thing. So let me see here. We've got
we started with 18 people. We played down to a final three. So that's 15 being eliminated, but Dana was not at a tribal council. So I think it's 14. Oh, plus final tribal council is 15 tribal councils.
I don't know if we count a final tribal in there, but yeah, either way, 14/15. I guess it's theoretically possible if you start with 20 and work your way down to a final three. But even then, it's how many in there could you afford to miss, assuming no re-entry via Redemption Island or anything like that?
Yeah, I don't know that is going to be touched, at least not anytime soon, based on current Survivor structure, although they did release like a 41-second clip or whatever of Jeff Probst promoting this upcoming season 41, which appears to be scheduled for this fall, talking about how it's somehow a lot more dangerous now and a totally, I don't want to get the words wrong, but I got the sense that we may be in for a radical kind of format shift, at least conceivably, and the show is much more difficult to win these days. I'd totally TBD along those lines. Suffice to say, it's very difficult to go to more than all of the tribal councils over the course of a season, so I feel pretty comfortable.
So thinking about it more, I don't think it's that unreasonable, because by definition, right, if you get to the merge, you then go to every future tribal council if you're going to win in the first place, or even just get, like, you could be a zero vote losing finalist and still get that consolation prize of having gone to every single tribal council. And so with Philippines, where it's 18, but Dana quits, let's say you take the Dana quit and that's the one challenge that Denise's tribe manages to win somehow. If you extend that to a 20-player season and you add in another win and another loss in there, you know, you can imagine someone going to like 7 out of 9 or 6 out of 8 pre-merge tribal councils, making it to the merge, going to all the others, and that at least ties Denise's record, if not beating it.
I don't necessarily mean the record in terms of sheer number attended. I mean completing 100% of going to every single tribal council over the course of a season is pretty tough to outdo. And similarly, there may come a time where Survivor decides they want to spend more time in the pre-merge, or they start casting more people for whatever reason, where we see a tribe win more than the, I believe it is 8 for both. Although, actually, I didn't necessarily look this one up for Survivor Palau, but Karor in Palau and the Moto tribe also, people don't talk nearly enough about this, in Fiji, won every single pre-merge immunity challenge.
Yeah, and Michelle Fitzgerald as well, actually. You look at the voting chart, it's very weird for Karong, where she just has an entire row of white up until the 8th vote at the merge, where, you know, it goes Nick and then Debbie and so on. And it almost feels like, you know, she didn't skip half the game. She was there, you know, having to do stuff. But I wonder what the other side of that symmetry is. Like, who went to, Chris Underwood aside, who went to the fewest tribal councils during their run?
It's got to be Michelle, right?
You'd think so. Who else would even be in the mix, though? Like Tom?
Yeah, Tom's actually a pretty good bet there. I don't know, but you it's hard to go to fewer tribal councils pre-merge than Michelle ended. And I think Nick Majorano also ran the table in pre-merge challenges there. But those are in largely three tribe situations where you just need to not come in last for the most part, whereas the Karor tribe and Moto tribe both outright won every single immunity challenge pre-merge, which again has like the Tandang tribe did that, I think, in Philippines, but that it's a different situation for me when it's three tribes and it's fewer challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how about, Dom, speaking of winners not necessarily making the biggest impression on Wikipedia charts, or maybe this isn't specifically on Wikipedia, but your Excel sheets that you will get on Survivor Sucks or wherever, Edge, whatever kind of confessional counters you were looking at, I have a very difficult time seeing any winner in Survivor history getting fewer than the 15 confessionals Natalie White got over the course of Samoa. In the modern age of editing Survivor winners, that seems completely impossible to me.
Yeah, we have had several both winners and just popular contestants get, you know, far outstripped that number in the course of a single episode. And for that not to feel like that is unexpected, given, you know, the rest of the season for that player. So, yeah, I think Natalie White is going to hold that title for the rest of time. And it's not one that you want to hold, but I think, you know, she'll take $1 million to the bank and be okay with it. And I think maybe if there was any winner who is okay with just not really being part of the season in that way, it's Natalie White, who seemed to want nothing really to do with Survivor after her win and has not been heard from in a very long time. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess it's good in a way that falls on her compared to someone who might take that burden more seriously. But yeah, I think that she fell in this era where you both had the Russell factor on, you know, the seasons that he was on, where unless it was Russell himself winning, like let's say that final tribal had broken for Mick, I don't know if Mick is really rising up the total confessional count all that much himself. But in addition, I think she fell in this maybe quite narrow window in the scope of Survivor where they felt okay about just deleting the winner from the season, basically, if they weren't excited about that person themselves. If they weren't excited about her themselves, then you just wouldn't see that person. And there was this implicit assumption that this is about the season as a whole, or maybe about other contestants on the season, and then the winner's kind of an afterthought. And if you like the winner, that's great, but you don't need to in order to appreciate the season. And then I would say, certainly by the time we get in the 30s and maybe a little bit before that, that has changed to the point where now if someone wins a season, if they are a conventional winner, then their thinking is you cannot get enough of this person, and they will just be rubbed in your face over and over again. And if it's not, then you at least see the signs coming from a mile away as to why it would hypothetically be this person, right? So, you know, Michelle, famously, the perfect example of this, but there are many others in that run as well. I don't know exactly when that transition happened, but either way, with Natalie White, I think there was no way that Natalie, regardless of the outcome on the season, was going to be a big presence, right? Where if she gets voted out at any point before that, she is the kind of Purple Kelly of Samoa. And even if she wins, even if she gets the outcome which should entitle her to a much greater attention than she received, like, she doesn't even get that much herself. So I think she was that outcome was basically inevitable given the conditions she found herself in.
Yes, I'm fully with that. And actually, staying somewhat on Michelle here, I think this next record is one where she is the heavy front runner, as far as I am remembering, as things stand right now, to be the person, if anyone is going to break this record, I feel like she's got to be the easy number one contender at this point, if she were to get a third opportunity on Survivor. But a record that I would be betting against ever being broken is Amanda Kimmel beginning her Survivor career with something in the neighborhood of like 108 consecutive days in the main game, like making it through to the finals both of her first two seasons and then being a relatively early post-merge, but they merged pretty late on Heroes versus Villains Casualty there. That is a pretty ludicrous number, no matter how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although Michelle, again, has gone 78 for 78 to this point, I believe. So if she does find herself back there, Michelle versus Wendell, season 42, let's make it happen. That is certainly a record that could be in jeopardy. And furthermore, I think pretty much any total days played record is still in jeopardy, just with no concept of how much longer Survivor may end up going, but no real reason to believe that someone couldn't potentially have not even played yet and still find their way onto four or five seasons to set a new all-time record. I don't think that's the craziest thing at all. So let's move over to a couple of things that were pretty season-specific or maybe era-specific, but I do think are kind of interesting and are going to be difficult records to break. I would have said this about Chris Underwood until we saw Edge of Extinction come back, and Natalie Anderson went from being booted, I believe, on day two in Winners at War, and then spending somewhere in the neighborhood of like 33, 34, 35 days outside of the main game and then re-entering. I think that span of time between being active in the main game is pretty impossible to ever outdo.
And on the topic of Chris Underwood, I'm fact-checking this now. You would think Chris would be the automatic number one by some margin in terms of fewest tribal councils attended. By my count, it seems like, let me see. Yeah, it seems like he actually ties with Michelle in Koh Rong for that title where, you know, Michelle doesn't go there until the merge, and then Neil gets evacuated, so we're down to 10, and later on, Joe's going to get evacuated, so we only have 9, 8, 7, 6, and then 4. And then you look at Edge of Extinction, Chris goes through the first three, he comes back in at the final five to make it a final six, and then goes 6-5-4. So both of them only go to six during their entire run. So despite Chris just not even being in the game for the vast majority of it, he still has competition for that title somehow.
That is pretty amazing, yeah. And I was thinking about just like how weird it must have been for the players like in the main game who had, I would imagine, spent most of their time thinking about who else was active in the main game and will worry about the re-enterer whenever they end up showing up. To have people who were eliminated so early come back in, not at the first re-entry point, but at the second one, and have spent so much time out of the game, like at the point at which Chris and Natalie respectively re-entered the game, when was the last time anyone was even seriously talking about them as like someone worth considering within the game that the rest of the cast had been playing for like the last month at that point? It's got to be so weird to, not quite to the same level, but it feels to me like almost the Survivor equivalent of something they don't really do on US Big Brother, but I believe they do a lot more on International Big Brother, where like a new player no one's ever met or heard of will join the game after like two full months have passed. Like, it seems like that level of like, wait, who are you? Sorry. And it's obviously less so with Natalie in Winners at War, but still the same idea.
I think an underrated aspect of this actually is we mentioned it in terms of like, they didn't have to play the social game, right? As Sophie put it, everyone who gets voted out just goes through Aussie's Pleasure Dome and then goes to the jury. But it's not so much that Chris didn't have to form social relationships or whatever, even though that's somewhat true. It's that it's almost from the other direction. It's there's just no time for those people to be annoyed by them or to be shit-talking them, because why would you, right? Like, that's one aspect of the show that you hear about in the interviews. It doesn't really come across on the screen. It's just the boredom and the downtime and the how, you know, the people who are fun and charming and just a joy to be around, that works so much more in their favor, given the conditions, than you might think. And conversely, you know, if someone is annoying, when you get to kind of opt in or opt out of interacting with that person, or it's only in small doses, or, you know, it's much easier to handle that versus by the time you spent potentially up to 39 days on an island with someone in this high-stress situation, even the small things they do that annoy you, and maybe shouldn't even annoy you, but they do, they just become incredibly obnoxious. You go into full like bitch eating crackers mode with everyone that you're there with at that point. And if like the Chris Underwoods of the world just aren't there for you to be annoyed by, then of course you're going to have a higher opinion of them, because, you know, why wouldn't you?
Completely, yeah. And then a couple other things that no one has really had the opportunity to break, or at least very few have had the opportunity to break these records, but I do think they are interesting statistics that are worth noting, in the same way as like Cy Young throwing I think it was 511 career wins as a Major League Baseball pitcher. Like, the best pitchers generally aren't starting anywhere close to 511 career games, let alone winning all of them in the even slightly modern era. But don't quote me on all of that. But I think, for the record, Tina and Colby have a standalone record at making it to day 42 on Survivor, and obviously that's because they played on the only season that was 42 days long. And similarly, Tony, I think, is going to have a tough record to beat with 12 jury votes in a single season, and I believe that brings him up to 20 career jury votes to be the winner. Those are going to be very difficult to match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although a bit skewed more so than some of these other ones. How about this, Dom? I'm going to preface this by saying this is not a 100% confirmed thing. And if it were, I don't even know if this would count as like a record in the same spirit as the rest of these, but I do think it is at least worth flagging up. I don't know that we're ever going to see anyone like Colton, at least arguably, quit the game twice. I think that record is going to stand for a while.
Yeah, it's. I came close to. There was a Twitter thread the other day about quote this with your most unpopular Survivor opinions, and I had a lot that I was about ready to fire up, but I realized that most of those, it's not that they're unpopular, it's just that people agree with them, but those topics just don't come up enough for there to be any real controversy over those. And so one of them that was in the queue, but I ended up shunting out of it, was that Colton being cast for Blood vs. Water is actually like a very underrated kind of production misstep, something that somehow we just don't even really talk about much these days. And I'm sure some of that is he seems to have somewhat reformed now, although I don't know how much trust you can really put in that. And then, you know, the tragic situation with Caleb and so on and so forth. But just in terms of like casting him once, I think really had a terrible impact upon One World. And then once you've seen that, casting him again just seems inexplicable. I don't know why you would put people and, you know, put him and put his castmates, you put everyone involved basically through that ringer once more. And I know at the time we were saying, you know, we were going off about that, but it feels like now, you know, when we think back on that era, it's, oh, well, Brandon Hans should not have been on the show, or, you know, half the people on Caramone should not have been on the show, or certainly in recent seasons, like with the Dan Spiro thing, there are many glaring examples of kind of production failing in that duty to its contestants that we bring up, and somehow Colton just never seems to end up on that list anymore.
That is a fair point, but I mean, I think they were still at the phase in their kind of casting evolution where, in the case of Brandon, they were recognizing, oh yeah, he's very liable to have a complete mental breakdown, and that's why we want to put him on the show. And I think with Colton, they actively wanted him to go out there and be like as offensive and push it as hard as he could for, and then they of course can take the moral high ground with how they present him on the show and make it seem like, oh, isn't it so bad that this kid is doing this sort of thing? It's like, you're the ones who gave him this platform to do this sort of thing in the first place. But yeah, I larger point, I don't know that we are ever going to see that sort of generosity, for lack of a better term, with returnee invites anytime soon. I think they're a lot more skittish, not only along the Colton personality lines, but also the Colton kind of demeanor and effort within the game. I don't know that they are willing to give many second chances along those lines these days. What else, Dom? Oh, I did think that at least in the modern era, it would be pretty difficult for any tribe to go out there and outdo the snatching of defeat from the jaws of victory that we saw the Galoo tribe put themselves through in Samoa going into the post-merge with an 8-4 lead, which these days, I mean, it's extremely uncommon that we go the entire pre-merge without some tribe, without a tribe swap or some tribe swaps, and that a group could even have a very clear kind of numerical advantage to that extent, let alone then going on to come one Brett immunity necklace away from being booted over the next 8 consecutive tribal councils. We've certainly seen some tribes punt over the years in the post-merge setting. Tambira certainly comes to mind. However, the Galoo tribe, I think, has really set the gold historic standard. Historical? Heard it both ways, along those lines. And I think it'd be very difficult for any other group to come together and outdo that.
You do see it time and time again that it's actually the biggest groups, the ones that have this stonking supermajority, that often end up suffering the hardest fall and just really imploding and then completely falling apart. Where I think if there's a sense that, you know, it's on a thin margin and one wrong move could swing the game in their favor, or you could lose control more easily, that does instill more of a sense of unity and discipline. Whereas if you're up 8-4, you think, okay, we can take some time off to trim the fat a bit and get rid of some troublemakers. And then before you know it, everything falls apart.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is much better in the at least immediate terms to have a very thin majority, yes, than to have an enormous majority where people are going to start getting greedy and playing 6 rounds in advance. We need to be focused on making sure we're all locked in on tonight before we start cutting each other's heads off. But Dom, any others that came to mind for you? Again, I'm positive we are forgetting plenty and would love to hear from people for some of the notable ones that we have missed along the way. But do any others jump to mind?
So one that you have on the list, actually, is the Tom and Ian final immunity challenge going for, I don't know what the final count was, but it certainly was over 12 hours, and I think closer to 15, maybe. Maybe I'm even over-exaggerating that, but to this day, that is certainly the longest U.S. Survivor challenge. But I wonder if once you open the floodgates to any international contenders, that record gets swamped pretty quickly, where I certainly remember, and I remember this because it's the only thing, basically, that I remember about UK Survivor. I remember two things. There was a challenge where you had to, it was basically a time estimation thing where whoever, you know, all the contestants are in a circle, whoever leaves the circle closest to the hour mark without going over wins a challenge. And then the other thing, which I want to say was the final immunity between John and Johnny, and maybe a third person too, where it was just standing on a log, a pure endurance challenge, and I remember someone peeing off a log and being like very self-conscious about it, and that one went for over 24 hours. And even that, I think, in the grand scheme of things, I have to think there have been some truly insane endurance records set by certainly international Survivor contestants. And then if you open it up to other franchises, I'm sure like The Challenge or International Big Brother or something, you really could get some impressive stats off there.
I'm not confident at all in what the record would look like if we added in all of the international seasons. I know Australian Survivor tends to do some pretty epic endurance challenges near the end of their seasons, and I'm guessing they've put up some very solid numbers over the years, but I'm going to say right around 14 hours is my memory of when Ian eventually got heat stroke and decided to call it a challenge there and call it a season and call it a Survivor career. But that is a record I cannot ever see being broken. Caveat being on U.S. Survivor while Jeff Probst is the host. If someone else comes in and takes over as host and wants to go all day commenting on people standing still. We may see that challenged somewhere down the line, but I do not think Jeff is interested in that line of work these days. Maybe that's a totally unfair kind of placement of blame, if you want to call it that, on why we aren't getting these epic half-day-long immunity challenges anymore. But as fun as I always find them, I get that from Jeff's point of view and from the producer's point of view in general, because it all is pretty much going to fit into the same 7-minute, 9-minute chunk of TV time, regardless of how long it goes.
I mean, that being said, if they feel the need to really economize with the challenge budget, then what cheaper challenge is there than just, okay, here's a log, go stand on it, you know?
And it is really good. I'm definitely not trying to take away from the TV element of it, and I think, weirdly, some of the most memorable challenges are the ones where there was the least for them to do, and they were just standing there, and it was a battle of who wanted it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that as well, in an era of the fire challenge, it might feel kind of weirdly anticlimactic if you have people really burning the midnight oil up there on the log, or whatever the platform actually is, for 20 hours, and then the actual game itself just comes down to whoever wins this 10-minute fire challenge.
We're going a long way here with the Survivor twists that are all now feeling less dystopian and more realistic the more I hear Jeff Probst talk about season 41. But we will cross those bridges whenever we potentially get to them down the line. But I believe, Dom, that is going to do it for the Unbreakable Survivor Records, parentheses, maybe just part one of Unbreakable Survivor Records, depending on if other people have a bunch that we have forgotten about. I think these are interesting sorts of things to talk about and wax nostalgic about. So do tweet us with anything we have potentially overlooked. One more time, he is at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. But Dom, unless you have any others, but don't let me cut you off if you have any other good ones.
I think that does it for now. But yeah, certainly would be keen to hear any other suggestions that people have, and maybe we'll do like a short follow-up segment covering those if there are enough good ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's wrap up this month of May here with another round of No More Lockies. And let me say at the top here, Dom, I have a couple of rule change proposals. Number one, after last time, I'm nervous to do this because I could see you attempting to abuse this, but I propose that we do some sort of veto something where once per game maximum, specifically I am allowed to say, I am confused by that rule that you were trying to put into place and I don't want to fall victim to it. Come up with something easier. I'm vetoing it.
I feel like that's someone who feels desperate, you know? They feel like they can't win in a fair fight and so they have to switch the rules up in their favor.
All right, let's just try to keep it within the, let's not pass the point of ridiculousness with the rules deliberately intended to confuse Colin, please. Rule change proposal number two, at least for today. I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world to try this with a 2-minute shot clock, just given how long some of these games have gone recently.
Oh, 2 minutes might be an eternity, honestly.
We can play that by ear, but for today, I'm going to be setting a 2-minute shot clock. And thirdly, and this is the final one, but I have been a lot more generous with you than I am necessarily going to be now that you have started to narrow the gap a bit in terms of overall score here. The rule is a name is submitted when you have then put in the following category that applies to that person. So you can toss out whatever names you want to toss out. When you say your next rule, that is when the name has been submitted, and today is the day where I am no longer accepting, wait, no. The rule is submitted when it's submitted. I believe it is the case that in single Jeopardy, you don't get penalized for forgetting to say what is fill in the blank, but in double Jeopardy, they will not warn you to frame it in the form of a question. We are in double Jeopardy now, Dom.
Yeah, we're in double Jeopardy. I have a great lead, and you don't want to be mathematically locked out by the time we get to Final Jeopardy.
I believe I still am the one up on the overall match score here. I think we are sitting at 3-2. So, for anyone new to No More Lockies, sorry, there will be no explanation of the rules. Hopefully they become clear contextually. I'm optimistic that as you just hear the game played out, it will pretty quickly become apparent what is going on here. As usual, two incorrect challenges means game over. Dominic, would you like to be player zero or player one?
Player one.
Okay. You were learning, by the way, because I believe player one is pretty close to undefeated, although that should be a complete fluke. But in any event, I, as player zero, will choose a season, and Dom will begin the game with a contestant from that season. So, Dom, take your pick from Survivor Gabon.
Survivor Gabon. Okay. Well, I feel like this first one's addressed itself. Bob Crowley, No More Mainers.
Okay. I feel like you're playing right into my hand, because I definitely know all of the contestants from Maine, and I don't know if you do.
Well, look, that Maine has to have something to hang his hat on, I suppose. So there we go.
Yes. So, Mainers off the board. That should hopefully not cause me too many problems along the way. I am going to go for... let's see. I want to do a twist on a rule that we played early in last game, and we both ended up forgetting about it and submitting multiple violations, but since we had both forgotten about it, the other one never called them on it. I am going to play someone who is not from Maine. I am going to play Jim Lynch, our first boot from Guatemala. And I am going to say no more people who played on seasons that are multiples of 11. So 11, 22, and 33 off the board.
Okay. Jeez. All right. Give me Dan Barry. No more people who, if not fully bald, are at least balding and the target audience for that kind of male hair care product.
Okay. I believe we can play that one by ear as it comes up, and hopefully I don't forget about it and lose the game on the along those lines. I am going to go for, let's play Jim Rice, and I will do no more one and ones. So one syllable first name, one syllable last name off the board.
Okay.
Because we did last time, we did no more one syllable last names, period, and that was an enormous handcuff on both of us. Similarly, you did no more blondes one time, and that there are some that are just so painful to try to play through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally fair.
One and ones,
give
though,
me
not welcome.
Okay. I'll go with... Adam Gentry, no more Survivor contestants who are in relationships with Big Brother contestants.
So, quickly, who was he in a relationship with? Because this is brand new to me.
Oh, Erica from BB4 and BB Allstars.
Did not know that, but happy for the both of them. So, it is
she,
over...
My understanding is she has dated a lot of the just most grungy contestants from various franchises across the years, so hopefully happy with whoever she's with now.
All right, I am going to play, let's do Alicia Rosa from One World, and I am going to go for no more people whose first and last names both end with the same letter.
God, okay. Sure.
Feel good about the number of syllables. I feel good about her not being from Maine. I don't think she's bald.
She might be now. Who knows? As of recording, give me Tommy Sheehan, no more teachers.
Okay, man, I'm going to get tripped up on that one. And off the top of my head, can't come up with any of the rules being violated to this point. So I think I need to... Teachers meaning school teachers only, right? Not people who could be, like, argued as teachers.
Like, educators? Or, I mean...
so I'm nervous coaches. About, like, coaches or whatever.
Okay, school teachers, yeah.
Okay, okay. I will then go for... I am inclined to do another occupational one, although I am very nervous about falling into this trap myself. But I will play Eliza Orleans, I believe. I feel okay about this. And I'm going to play No More Lawyers.
Okay. So can I... ruling here from the umpire... If I give a new contestant now and name a rule, can that apply retrospectively to someone who has already been named?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's no more of these people. Yes. You don't have to fade everyone the whole way. Yeah.
Yeah. So with that in mind, give me Rupert Bonham, no more candidates for political office.
Okay. All right. I think we're good on Rupert, unfortunately, at this hour. Rupert, okay. I will go for, let's see. I want, oh man, almost played a 1-1. Can't do that. I will play, I think I'm okay playing Aubrey Bracco. And I am going to go for no more signature glasses. No more anytime you think of them, they're wearing glasses, essentially.
Okay. Aubrey has a luscious head of hair, as I recall. So not catching you out on that one.
I'm risking. I know she's not from Maine, but she's from New Hampshire. So I'm living on the edge there.
Yeah.
And I'm already struggling to come up with any future plays, let alone try to call Dom on the rules. So, audience, I hope you're very ready to be frustrated by all the stuff. At least I am about to overlook when Dom violates half the rules.
Huh.
Okay. And I've also forgotten completely about this clock, but I am now clicking the 2 minutes on the show.
Yeah. To be fair, I think we've been pretty timely so far. We are making good time.
It's not so much the early rounds. It's the later rounds that have a tendency to take a while.
And whenever we say we are making good time, that invariably ages like curdled milk before too long. So I'm not wishing to jinx that one there. Give me... Oh, this could really make life tougher. Checking this one's actually valid, though, before I commit. Okay, give me Amber Mariano, No More Parents.
No More Parents is, I mean, absolutely bonkers. No More Parents is an utterly insane rule to be implementing here, but we will roll with it. I am going to go for Colleen Haskell. No More People... What?
To be clear, this is No More Parents at the time where they went on a Survivor season.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Okay.
Not ruling out the vast swathe of people who had a baby at some point in their life afterwards.
Okay. I'm going to thank you, because I don't know what Colleen's situation is, but I believe
No one does. She's an enigma, as far as I know.
Slay. Have at it. Colleen is playing it 100% right, based on as much as I can tell, as far as being a former reality TV star is concerned. Just do one movie with Rob Schneider and then call it a day. That's the game plan. I am going to play...
Somehow undetected by Ben Waterworth, legions of minions after all these years.
I will play Colleen, and I will say no more people who have the same letter appear in their combined first and last names 4 or more times. So in this case, the L in Colleen Haskell.
That's definitely a case of, are you going to name a contestant and then figure out a rule rather than the other way around?
You hit me with No More Parents. I mean, that you know you were just taking a buzzsaw to any chance that this game has of going smoothly.
The literal next person I was going to name was Wendell Holland, who would have just right in the face of that rule. So going to have to reassess.
All right, 2 minutes now. Beginning now.
Oh, God.
No more parents isn't. That might be the harshest rule ever played, if I'm being honest.
Almost said Adam Klein, who is most certainly a 33er. Don't want to get called out that rule.
I've been sitting here just praying for you to forget that rule, so apparently I need to wait a little longer.
Okay. Give me...
No More Parents is a nightmare. Oh, my God. You have a minute and 15.
All right, give me Caleb Reynolds, No More Medivacs.
Ooh, okay. Caleb Reynolds, No More Medivacs. You're living dangerously close to the multiples of 11 there. You know, I am very inclined. I am not certain about this challenge, but I'm inclined to do it. It feels likely to me. This is the issue I'm running into. We had a rule of no more people who've dated Big Brother contestants. What are we calling dating?
Caleb did not date Amber, except in his own mind.
No, I mean, after his Big Brother career, I'm guessing he is rendezvoused with multiple Big Brother contestants.
I'm not talking about, like, give kids the world, hookups or whatever. Okay. We don't need to get into that murky territory.
So I don't know that I can prove this. I don't think I can go for that challenge. There are going to be a couple others that may be challenged down the line.
If the gloves are coming off and you want to go full TMZ on this this game of pinball hockeys, then have at it. But yeah, you do you.
Does this person have to know that they're a parent? So I am going to have to unfortunately let that one sit, and now I'm going to start the 2 minutes on myself. Sorry. What rule did you? Oh, you played No More Medivacs. Okay, Heatstroke Cowboy, classic. So, man, we are already getting down to it. I believe I can safely play... I have a minute and a half here. I don't need to rush it. I can think this one through. I will go... For someone, I'm very inclined to just keep this old school so I don't run into any kind of game-related or twist-related problems down the line. I will play... Oh, man, the parents one is just destroying me right now. Sorry, listening audience, I have 1 minute left. And now all I can think about are people who are parents from the early season. So this is off to a disastrous start.
Yeah, don't think of an elephant, Colin. Just under
seriously,
no circumstances,
that's,
think
that's
of an
that's
elephant.
Exactly what is going on here. Oh, man, I had one, but I think I have to let that one go. I'm going to... 30 seconds left now on my own clock. I am going to go for... Let's keep it thematic. This is the first one that crossed my mind. I'm a little nervous, but we'll see how this goes. I'm going to play Clarence Black, and I'm going to say No More Merge Boots.
Okay. No idea what his occupation was.
He was a basketball coach, I believe.
Okay, just straying close to the line there, but within the bounds, for sure. I'm going to just make sure that Clarence had hair before I let that one
slide by. Is this an official challenge? Are you challenging?
Hmm. This is, there's some hair on there. You know, we're not fully bald just yet.
Did you look it up?
I may have done.
Okay, that's a challenge. You can't just look it up and then decide if you want a challenge, by the way. You get to use Google once you... officially challenge. Oh, okay. I'm that was the one I was nervous about, but I'm home free on that one.
Yeah, this feels intentional. This is a buzz cut. This isn't, I am giving in to the ravages of aging.
For sure.
This is, you know.
That's a challenge by you, if you're looking it up, by the way.
That's a very nice head of hair, actually. Yeah, so okay. Anyway.
Dom has used a challenge, for the record.
Yes. So, no more, nothing left in the tank over there anymore, and it is back on me.
Your 2 minutes has begun.
I'm going to say Chelsea Townsend. No more medics. So no kind of doctors, paramedics, EMTs, anything in that space.
All right. We are getting absolutely wrecked on remembering all of the rules here. And I feel like it's very unlikely that at least one of us has gone the entire time without breaking at least one or two of the rules established to this point. But I am so far...
To clarify your Alicia Rosa rule, it's the first name and the last name can't end with the same letter.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
I was honestly secretly holding out hope that you'd forgotten about that one. So there goes my next path to victory. Let's see. It is. I think I got to let Chelsea Townsend go. So my 2 minutes is now beginning. I will... go, man, this no parents thing is absolutely brutal. And I was about to play someone that I believe actually at one point in his career was a merge boot, so let's not do that. If memory serves, I think Ozzy was the merge boot in Game Changers, right? I think that is true. I'm not interested. Oh no, he wasn't. Oh, hang on. Yeah, Haley, right? I'm questioning my own memory, and now I'm getting caught up on other things. And now I'm tempted to play Haley Ford, because she was certainly not a lawyer. She was a law school student. Can I get away with that? Because we didn't...
We are not opening up that...
Okay, so I have...
I was about to say kettle of worms. That is definitely mixing my metaphors, but you know what I'm saying. Can of worms. Kettle of fish. There we go.
I have 1 minute left, and I think I have landed on someone... that I am going to play, and that person is Jacob Derwin. And I am going to play... what do I want to play? Let me make sure. I have 40 seconds left to officially submit that name. I feel okay about it. And I am going to play no one who has been exiled on whatever the exile... twist was.
Jeez, okay.
On their season.
Huh. I'm definitely going to forget about like a season just having any form of exiling flat out, right? And then walk into that somehow.
I hope so. I am too, so happy hunting to both of us.
Let's whittle down these numbers a little further. Give me Penny Ramsey, no more seasons that are multiples of five.
All right. Penny Ramsey... no more seasons that are multiples of five. Dominic, I am going to challenge. I am going to win.
Yeah.
Penny and Ramsey both end in the letter Y, as recently clarified in the Alicia Rosa rule. So,
yeah, I asked about it just to make sure it was at the top of your mind, so I could, you know, give myself a challenge when I tried to sneak that one past you. No, I played myself. I walked right into that one.
And I will say it for you, and I'm only doing this because I have a name in mind that I am able to play to prove it, to secure victory here. The way we have been doing it, at least, is when your opponent loses, you have to play one more correct submission to prove your status as that day's victor. Otherwise, it is a double loss. I will start the 2 minutes on my clock just to think this one through and not punt it away.
I'm going to say for future episodes, I think that last kind of rebound should have a very short shot clock just to add some real suspense in there.
2 minutes seems totally reasonable to me. Now, if you're the one doing it next time, you're welcome to do it in 30 seconds. So the name that I have in mind is Rob Zabaknik. I don't think he there's no way he's a teacher, right?
Is that your final answer?
I don't believe he has kids. I'm just going to play Rob Zabaknik. If he's a teacher, so be it.
Okay, so clarification here. If I name someone and give a rule, and then your kind of confirmed answer to lock it up violates that rule that is about to be in place, what happens?
A rule is not put into place if it is... Obviously, I would not take someone from his multiple of five. It doesn't count as a rule if you're
okay,
incorrect
well,
on it.
With that technicality out of the way, I must admit defeat here.
Okay, yeah. And you will know. That's not just me making that call on the fly. If you watch the original No More Jockeys, that is a running rule on there as well, is that a rule is not inserted if it is on a name that gets elimination.
Yeah.
All right. Well, a job well done, and finally a reasonably timed game of No More Lockies there. We currently sit, Dom, at 4-2, and this is a game played in tennis scoring, so it's 1-6, but must win by 2. So we will see how this continues to progress. I gotta say, after going up 3-1 and then punting away the last game, more specifically, after you put in multiple names that violated the rules, as it turned out.
When you're clarifying there, we have both punted each of the last few games. It's just that someone has to lose. That's how the game works. And, you know, someone has to punt harder.
Right. And I'm very prepared to hang this up, post the episode online, and very quickly find out that there were several opportunities along the way here for either of us to have secured victory long ago. But for today, I believe that is going to finally do it. Unless, Dom, you have anything else you want to get to?
No, I'm done.
Just go... I'd hang out with ravioli in the dark, like God intended. This is not your day.
I need a big hug from those toe beans to console me. I would say I'm good, but I'm not good. I'm terrible. I'm really feeling it right now.
Well, that's how you know you have executed on a job well done when you're playing No More Lockies, is that kind of reaction from your opponent. So thank you guys, of course, for continuing to tune in. And for anyone interested, bonus episodes every week over on the Patreon feed at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. It is $5 a month, and at this point, I've got to be well over 100 bonus episodes up over there. So do be checking that out if that would interest you. But until then, we will talk to you guys soon. Take care, guys.